Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up, Pope Benedict reflects on the conversion of St. Paul and the Apostles' teaching on our justification. Catholic bishops in India condemn what they call a terrorist attack on a Pentecostal church in Mumbai. An angry mob accusing the church of conversions beat and stripped its Protestant pastor and ransacked the building, destroying sacred images. This is the first time that a church is attacked in Mumbai since last August, when a wave of violence hit Christians first in the state of Orissa and then other Indian states. Coming up on the program, we'll have an analysis of what is fueling the violence against Christians in parts of India. And finally, an important church-sponsored seminar on migration gets underway in Liverpool, England. At the General Audience in St. Peter's Square on Wednesday, Pope Benedict continued his reflections on the life and works of St. Paul. Today he spoke about the Apostles' teaching on our justification.
Dear brothers and sisters, in our continuing catechesis on St. Paul, we now consider his teaching on our justification. Paul's experience of the risen Lord on the road to Damascus led him to see that it is only by facing Christ, and not by any merit of our own, that we are made righteous before God. Our justification in Christ is as God's gracious gift, revealed in the mystery of the cross. Christ died in order to become our wisdom, righteousness, sanctification, and redemption. And we in turn, justified by faith, have become in him the very righteousness of God. In the light of the cross and its gifts of reconciliation and new life in the Spirit, Paul rejected the righteousness based on the law and its works. For the apostles, the Mosaic law, as an irrevocable gift of God to Israel, is not abrogated but relativized, since it is only by facing God's promises to Abraham, now fulfilled in Christ, that we receive the grace of justification and new life. The law finds its end in Christ and its fulfillment in the new commandment of love. With Paul, then let us make the cross of Christ our only boast and give thanks for the grace which has made us members of Christ's body, which is the Church. I am pleased to greet the participants in the International Catholic Scouting Conference meeting in Rome. Upon all the English-speaking pilgrims and visitors present to this audience, especially those from England, Ireland, Denmark, Norway, Finland, South Africa, and the United States, I call in for God's blessings of joy and peace.
Though you don't often hear much about them, there are millions of Christians in India, a community which has grown from the time Jesus' apostle, the doubting Thomas, first set foot on Indian soil. Today, Christians make up some 24 million people. That may sound like a lot, but they account for less than 3% of the majority Hindu population. Muslims, who form the largest religious minority, account for 11% of the population. Other religious groups, including Jains, Buddhists, Sikhs, Parsis, and Jews, together make up a mere 4%. Well, in recent years, Christian leaders in India have expressed dismay that some elements in society have been twisting religion for political ends. Extremist Hindu nationalists have been accused of fueling a climate of hatred against Christians, whom they blame for India's past history of colonial rule. They also say some religious minorities enjoy greater social privileges than Hindus. Well, as we've seen, dozens of Christian homes, churches, and clergy have come under attack in recent years in areas like the eastern Indian state of Orissa. Nuns and priests have been brutally murdered and church buildings and property burnt to the ground. Well, to explore some of the complicated background of the tensions between Christians and Hindus in some parts of India, I talked with a spokesman for the Catholic Bishops' Conference of Andhra Pradesh, Father Anand Mutungal, who gives us some insight.
What has taken place in the recent times, the fundamentalism has risen to a very great extent. It is a fundamentalism by the Hindu movements, very especially something called Hindutva. Their movement has become very strong in Madhya Pradesh and in the nearby Hindi belt. So it's a result of this uprising of the Hindu movements that is causing a great trouble and violence in the state here.
To what extent do you think this current tension is the result of fears about Christian evangelization or conversion of Hindus to Christianity?
See, to tell you the fact, you know, there are no much forced conversions taking place in India as a whole, and very especially in this Hindi-speaking area in Madhya Pradesh. Now, why they are accusing, it has become a political issue. They want to politically accuse the Christians of conversion. The accusation of conversion is not real, but it is a political agenda, a religious political agenda, which is persuaded by the Hindutva movement, very especially RSS, VHP, Bajrangadal, and this movement.
Do you think that India's caste system comes into play in these tensions?
I don't think a caste system plays a major role into this one. It is a fanatic movement that has come up in the basis of like Nazism, fascism, in this level. It is trying to prove that Hindus are today much, much bigger, greater and they are higher than the other community. They are trying to impose their views on the Christians now. It's an imposition of culture. It's a cultural inversion, I must say, cultural war. We must go back to the 200 years of history of India, where the Christianity came to India. It definitely had no tolerance with the Hindu community. It has been trying to dominate the Hindu culture. Now the Hindu community began to feel now they are in a position where they can dominate the Christians now. And it is a way they are trying to impose their culture and their dominance in the community. So it is a long historical war.
Heard certain priests in India say that the people who have converted from Hinduism to Christianity have come from the lower castes in India, who are far more unfortunate than many of the upper caste Hindus, and that they're doing so of their own free will.
Yeah.
What does Christianity offer these low caste Hindus that they don't find in their own religion?
See, madam, what is happening, the Christianity gives them an equal status in the society. And those people who feel that they have been ill-treated because they are coming from the low caste and their poverty to a great extent has paved a way for to change their religion into Christianity. But unfortunately, I must honestly and humbly accept those people who got converted from this lower caste has not been able to be inculcated very well into the Catholic Church, neither into the Protestant churches. They are still considered a low class in many of the areas.
Why is that, Father? Is there something within our churches, the Christian churches, that prevents these people from being considered as equals?
See, madam, what is happening is the clergy and the sisters, the nuns, all these categories, most of them have come from an upper economically and socially well area. They have been quite well in that area. So this particular group that is coming into this group doesn't seem to be financially and in socially doesn't seem to be that sound. This has paved the way for another sort of thinking in the church that this low caste people who are coming low caste needs to be considered. And second point adding to this, there is a reservation set by the government of India. Those who are in the SC, means the scheduled caste people, get the reservation from the government.
Dalits are among India's poorest Hindu castes. Once known as the untouchables or the oppressed, many have converted to Christianity freely because Christian clergy say Christians do not or should not recognize social inequalities such as castes. For this reason, Christians are not included in India's government policy on castes, which provides social assistance and educational advantages and guarantees a number of government and civil jobs for members of deprived castes. So ironically, if a Hindu becomes Christian, he will lose the government benefits attributed to his social class.
Now, the people who adopt the faith of Christianity also manage to get this concession from the government. So they do not reveal that they are Christian. They write still in their documents that they are Hindu. And they get the benefit of the benefit that the government gives them in the name of reservation for the scheduled caste. This is also one reason why Christians are still wants to persuade that they are from the low caste. And church also is supporting this movement because church has set up a commission in the CBCI where they are arguing for the benefit of the people who are converted from the lower classes.
So-called Dalit Christians have launched appeals to the government to reinstate their former social benefits in order to improve their employment opportunities.
I don't really honestly think the church has honestly worked to reduce these disparities existing in the society either.
Well, it sounds like the church has some internal reforming to do, but also a greater commitment to ensuring the political and civil rights of poor Christians on a social level.
I would rather add to what your question is. There is also an element of, conversion taking place in the Protestant circle. These conversions are mainly being engineered by offering some things. And these conversions mostly are funded, conversion groups are funded by the USA, Canada, all these missions from these countries, wherein independent churches are coming up. And they are pumping in money for some time when the conversions and they are withdrawn. And the people who get converted, then they start making problems for the church. And Catholic Church being an established church, they face a lot of problem. Therefore, suppose this tension has to be stopped in India on these levels of conversion, this sort of funding by these independent churches also needs to be stopped. Otherwise, this tension between communities and between religions will keep on growing.
Well, I know that the World Council of Churches is working on a set of guidelines on conversion together with the Vatican. Are you familiar with that project? And what do you think?
I have been through. I will go through the internet to find out what is the policy of the World Council of Churches. But the question comes here. The pastors were working independently in different parts of the world. They find their counterpart in our country, in India, and they start funding, who may not be part of the World Council of Churches at all. And they really start converting people in the lines of giving them something, all this, only for a certain short period. Afterwards, they withdraw. And World Council of Churches, how is it going to control the mission activities that is carried on by the independent churches in India? Therefore, I rather would say it is the duty of the governments like US government, Canada government, they must frame policies to stop such sort of frog activities done by their missionaries in India. That would be rather better if we want peace in India.
Father Anand Mutungal is a spokesman for the Catholic Bishops Conference of Andhra Pradesh. War, persecution, and poverty, the main reasons why so many people are forced to leave their homes and homeland in search of a better life. How do we as Christians treat these people, whom we call refugees, migrants, immigrants, when they appear on our shores? What can we do to help them integrate into our societies? What can we do to help them and their countrymen at home, so they will not feel the need to leave their native land in the first place? Well, these are some of the questions that will be examined this week by participants at a special seminar in Liverpool in Northern England. Our very own Linda Bordoni was invited by the Archdiocese of Liverpool to cover the event, which runs from the 19th through the 23rd and focuses on migrants as a new point of evangelization and solidarity. She talked earlier with Liverpool Archbishop Patrick Kelly about the seminar and its theme, In This Age of Human Mobility.
We've had to face the fact that you cannot understand the European story unless you understand the African story. We tend to put it the other way around. We tend to say you can't understand Africa without Europe. But you've also got to put it the other way around. For example, let's be quite frank about it. You cannot understand the prosperity in a country like my own England in electricity if you don't take account of copper from Zambia. And the story could be repeated in over and over again.
What is exactly the aim of this symposium?
The aim is to first of all, to recognise the truth. Almost like a reconciliation and truth commission. What is the truth about the relationships between the African continent and the story of Europe? But also facing new issues which touch especially the countries around the Mediterranean, the questions of migration, asylum seekers, those who are called, and I cringe at the word, economic migrants. I have to say my father was an Irish economic migrant who left Ireland to find greater prosperity in England. So I think it's a very dangerous word to use. It seems to dismiss people far too quickly. But we've got to face that not only is there a past story, of which the most horrendous element was, of course, the slave trade, but there are issues today of migration and indeed of authentic trade, which recognises what should be the return for the resources which still the rest of the world finds in and from Africa.
So we still have to acknowledge that, really, don't we?
Absolutely. We've got to acknowledge it very severe. And in a way, Liverpool is privileged to welcome this conference, but there's also, in a sense, a debt. And that's why, quite practically, I've said it's right that all those taking part are the guests of our diocese. I'm not saying, therefore, we've lots of money which we can spare. I've just been told today, here in the middle of October, that in up to September, the drop in our portfolio, because of the economic problems, dropped by 15%, and it's dropped since. So those are part of our reality. But still, there's no doubt at all that the prosperity, especially the west coast of England, is inseparable from the reality of the slave trade.
Also, the fact that Liverpool has been chosen as the seat, the venue of this symposium is not by chance, is it?
No, it's because we are this year the European Capital of Culture. And what I think I can say is that the committee, whoever they are who organise these things, have said Liverpool's proved to be one of the best they've ever had. Now, the reason is twofold. It's not just we've had some wonderful, what you might call, high culture. We've had, for example, the Berlin Philharmonic conducted by Simon Rattle. We've had three amazing requiems using the two cathedrals, one the world premiere by John Taverner's requiem in the Metropolitan Cathedral, which was breathtaking. Then the War Requiem was performed in Liverpool Anglican Cathedral, but was also performed deliberately in Cologne Cathedral 2 days later. Again, facing the fact the two cities were once, well, bombed by each other. And the third was Verdi's Requiem in the Metropolitan. But also there have been many things of very popular nature. Silly things in a way, like we had 100 what they call super lamb bananas around the city, which were like a lamb with a banana for a tail. And it's one of these things which grabbed everybody's fascination, and children could sit on them and be photographed.
What kind of an installation?
Just there, just for fun. And I think it's a good time to be coming. And on a quite serious level, it's arguable this will be the most significant event when we think of what culture really means, What is the Story Liverpool? This will be the most international event of the whole year. Now, it won't be big in numbers. They say when the tall ships came in, there were 1 million people. Now, we won't have 1 million people, but in terms of its significance, the gathering from across Europe and across Africa, I think it's going to be very significant. And the Lord Mayor's
going to talk. You were also mentioning before when we were speaking that not only is Liverpool the capital of culture, of European culture this year, but it's also a very significant place on the map because of the slave trade.
It is, because it was, when we think of the slave trade, and it's to do with the port, but it's what you call the triangle, a triangle of a terrible trade. The ships sailed from Africa to the Americas with slaves. They sailed from the Americas back to the west coast of England, mainly, because of, that's the Atlantic side, with raw materials. Out of that arose, for example, very significant trades. Liverpool was one of the main factories for Tate and Lyle sugar. It was one of the main places for British America tobacco. It had a huge cotton industry and wood. And all those raw materials came from Latin America. So the ships came back laden with raw materials. Then they sailed back to Africa with finished products. So the owners made money on all three legs of the journey.
Now we're talking about a kind of slavery that, thank God, doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. But new kinds of slavery do exist in today's society. Will this also be one of the...
Yes, we intend to look at issues like small things. What sort of welcome do students from other countries receive when they come to our city? Many do. From China, for example. Many Chinese students study in Liverpool. We're also going to look at the question of, for example, we have different names across Europe. In England, the name we use is travellers. And they can be a minority. They're not coloured, so you don't see them. But they can have a very difficult time because they have a slightly different culture, a certain different way of relating. And we're going to look at some of those issues as well. And, of course, we do have asylum seekers. We are one of the places where asylum seekers are sent away from London to disperse them. And one of the churches where we will celebrate Mass, the presbytery, which is very big, was once a monastery, in fact, that is now a base to assist asylum seekers in Liverpool.
So do you foresee the participation of, say, asylum seekers and migrants in some of the events?
We intend to. We've got to be very honest. There are not nearly as many migrants and asylum seekers in Liverpool as other parts of England. The reason is that, and I give a very simple example, the railway station, which is where most of the staff serving the conference symposium and people of the media will be staying, is near Lime Street Station. Not that long ago, between that station and the river, there were 900,000 people living. The total population today of the whole city is 440,000 because there isn't work. The docks, which used to employ tens of thousands, the tonnage is greater than it ever was, but it's all containerised and a ship turns round within 12 hours. So we've not got the migration because we haven't got the opportunities for work.
Briefly, just tell me a little bit about the symposium. You've mentioned a few of the events, but what will be happening day to day?
Well, what we're doing, we've got, if you like, three threads to it: the prayer, the formal lectures, and social, which are most days have a bit of all of them. We're doing some small things which I think are important. Every morning, the participants are invited to go to the cathedral for morning prayer, which will be open to the public. It is at 7:30, so we don't expect hundreds, but there is morning prayer every day in the cathedral at 7:45, but we're having it at 7:30. It will be in Latin and other languages to respond to those taking part. And it's near enough to the main hotel for people just to walk and then have breakfast. That's the constant thread. Then each day there are lectures, quite formal lectures, on various aspects of migration, asylum seeking, trade. And then there are social events. For example, we're going to have Mass in two parishes, two evening Masses, and afterwards the parish is going to welcome all the guests with a meal provided by... I mean, when I say by the parish, I don't mean the parish is paying for it. They're going to make it. which I think is
rather
nice.
They're actually
going to cook it. They will lay the tables, and they will work. You'll find beautiful people who will love doing this, and I think that should be very special. And then on the final evening, the Saturday evening, I've booked tickets for the Liverpool Philharmonic. There's a concert of two concert performances of two short operas. The Liverpool Philharmonic, the European Opera Chorus, and the conductor, our marvellous Russian conductor, Vasily Petrenko, is conducting. So, and we've invited to that, besides the participants, all the church leaders of Liverpool and their wives, because they're married church leaders, and the ecumenical officers of the northwest of England, again to give an ecumenical feel to it. And we'll gather for evening prayer, supper, then the concert.
And just briefly, who are the other participants going to
be? Well, we're still waiting. I know that Archbishop Onaiyekin is going to come from Nigeria,
yes.
And he's going to, as it happens, the BBC are broadcasting evening prayer live from the cathedral on the first evening. I've asked Archbishop Onaiyekin to give the sermon, and he's promised it will be 3 minutes, because the BBC insists it will be 3 minutes. So you know he's coming, and the Cardinal Archbishop of Zagreb is certainly coming. The others, I haven't seen the list. It's back in England. It's happened while I've been away. So 12 African bishops, 12 European
12
bishops.
12 African bishops, yeah. And 12 European,
yes,
bishops. It sounds very exciting.
Should be.
Thank you very much. Is there anything else you'd like to say about it? I see it's got a theme.
Yes, I was a stranger, you made me welcome, because that happens to be the gospel on the last Sunday. And it's a slight bonus, but it is public. We've had to make it public that the Sunday will be the Feast of Christ the King.
Right.
Which is the patronal feast of our cathedral, and it happens to be the Archbishop's 70th birthday.
Oh, goodness.
So it's going to be
big celebration.
A multifaceted celebration. I think the Lord Mayor is attending, the Lord Lieutenant, the Queen's representative, and it will be, I think, a significant occasion. And I think people will enjoy it, but the enjoyment, which has also got a very serious, solid side to it. But Liverpool is a very welcoming city. They've said the Year of Culture shone because of that. People gave examples like, unlike other cities, they would arrive, and if they were standing at the railway station with a map, within seconds somebody would stand and say, "Are you lost? Can I help you?" And
Liverpoolians are famous for
that, aren't they? So I think they should be all right. You know, they will be welcome, yes.
Thank you very much, Archbishop Kelly.
Archbishop of Liverpool Patrick Kelly is also Vice President of the Catholic Bishops' Conference for England and Wales. He was speaking there to Linda Bordoni. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.